the BetHealth Radio Show. And we do have the good doctor. She's standing by, ready and raring to go. That's Dr. Kia Lewis. She's your host this evening for the BetHealth Radio Show. And as usual, she has a guest or guests to keep you company as she gives you some medical information that I'm quite sure you want to hear. So let's turn our attention to Dr. Lewis and say a very good evening and welcome back, Doc.
Good evening, Gregson. It's a privilege to be here as usual. How are you?
Yes, I'm not too bad. Good to see you again.
Yes, good to see you. We've left you lonely in the studio for a week or two.
That's all right. I'll hold the fort until you get your back.
We're really happy to be back this evening to do another Better Health program. And as you know, this is a show that is aimed at raising public awareness of common health issues that affect us all. Absolute pleasure to be here. Looking forward to a really interactive session. We want to remind you that health is not the same without you. And so please take the opportunity to call in this evening with your questions and comments. The number to call in is 434-1790. That's 434-1790. Or you can send your WhatsApp messages to 266-4862. That's 266-4862. Now, we have been hearing quite a bit about the condition that we are going to be talking about this evening. We know that ever so often at certain times of the year, this particular condition spikes, and I'm talking of none other than dengue fever. So this evening, I know that some doctors have been reporting increases in cases of dengue. And in Barbados, we've become so used to it, you know, that sometimes we don't really think about it and we don't remember how dangerous dengue can be. But we want to put you on alert. We want to remind you of a few things about this condition that you might not have thought of. And this evening with us, we are happy to welcome back Dr. Marquita Gittin. She is no stranger to the program. We want to say a warm welcome to you this evening, Dr. Gittins.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Hi, Dr. Lewis. Hi, Gregson.
Very good. Let me just remind you a little bit about Dr. Gittins. For those of you who might not have met her or radio met her, so she is a lecturer in microbiology at the University of the West Indies, Cahill, and former director of the now defunct Leptospiral Laboratory. She specializes in molecular diagnostics of infectious disease, particularly arboviruses, leptospirosis, and has an avid interest in the investigation epidemiology of multi-drug resistant pathogens, genotypic and phenotypic characteristics. All big words to say she's an expert in this field. She's a member of CARIVET-NET Technical Working Group, American Society of Microbiology. She's country representative for Caribbean Association of Clinical Microbiologists and chair of the CARIVET-NET Technical Working Group, a member of the Quadripartite Technical Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance Use and Integrative Surveillance. Yet again, welcome, Dr. Gittins. Now, you know, we always like to start with definitions. We hear so much about dengue, but we're not going to assume that everybody knows what we're talking about. So tell us, when we're talking about dengue, what are we talking about, Dr. Gittins?
Hi, good evening one more time. When we're talking about dengue, we are really talking about an infection that is transmitted by a mosquito. And primarily the Aedes aegypti mosquito. So we would have heard, you know, a lot about that before. So it's infection transmitted by the mosquito, and it usually comes on very, you know, like a fever. It might start with a fever and so forth. A very non-specific type of infection. Not anything like the respiratory tract infections, not anything like a cold or anything like that. More of an overall infection that covers, you know, that you have headache and eye pain and that type of thing. But overall, it's primarily caused by the Aedes aegypti mosquito.
Okay. All right.
It's a viral infection caused by the Aedes aegypti mosquito.
Okay. And I know we know a lot about it here in Barbados, but I know it does not occur all over the world. Where do we really see cases of dengue? So if we were to travel outside of Barbados thinking, oh, we're escaping this mosquito, where else might we find dengue?
Well, it's generally found in tropical and subtropical areas. So you will find it just over all the Caribbean. You will certainly find it in South America. You might think that you might go to the U.S. and you might escape it, but the warmer regions of the U.S., you tend to have some cases there as well, places like Florida and so forth along the East Coast, some states along the East Coast, even up to Maryland, you might find some instances of dengue. You also find it in Southeast Asian countries, so India, you can find it in places like China, you can find it in Indonesia, Malaysia, all those places. You can find it in Africa, and you can also find it in Latin America, so in Brazil, Chile, those types of places is where you can also find it. So it's the Caribbean, all those tropical, as I said, and subtropical areas, the Caribbean, some parts of North America, we have South America being involved, and then we have across the ocean, we have Southeast Asia. Where we are likely to find it though would be in Europe and Antarctica. The when it occurs there is because maybe we had a tourist or something coming to Barbados or one of the tropical islands, picking up the infection and taking it back there. But generally don't find dengue normally in those countries unless it is brought in by one of the travelers to the particular place, to the country.
Okay, so a fairly widespread when you think about it.
It is quite large.
Yeah, in fact, World Health Organization estimates that there are about 50 to 100 million cases of dengue worldwide each year. So we know that this is a condition that can have a significant effect and impact, not just on Barbados, not just on the region, but worldwide. The other question I wanted to ask about, we know about dengue in itself, but there are different types of dengue, or what we call maybe different serotypes of dengue. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay, so there are four different serotypes of dengue. So there's dengue type 1, type 2, type 3, and type 4. So those are the different types of dengue that are in circulation worldwide. And the thing about dengue is that there are particular serotypes, particularly 2, that tend to result in a little bit more severe dengue. So the presentation of it tends to be a little bit more severe. And then there are some that seem to have the ability to just transmit really quickly, and that's dengue type 3. But, all 1, 2, 3, and 4, anybody's able to get any of those infections. And of course, if we want to go on a little bit further, you can have the presentation of your dengue might be different. So you might have gotten bitten by a mosquito that was carrying the dengue virus, and you may not have any symptoms. So some persons might not present with symptoms. Then some persons might present with a typical or classical presentation of dengue, which I'm sure we will get into a little bit later. And then we can have very severe forms of dengue. So we can have what is known as asymptomatic, no symptoms being seen. We can have the classic presentation of dengue, what most people will tend to present with. And then we get a more severe form of dengue, where we have their two basic classifications or categories of that. We have dengue hemorrhagic fever and dengue shock syndrome.
Right. And we're definitely going to delve into those because those are the red lights, the danger zone that we want people to know about. The other question I would then ask, because we talked about, being bitten by the mosquito, we know that's the main form of transmission. Can dengue be spread from one person to another? So if my mother comes home and says, the doctor suspects I have dengue, should I be afraid and kind of shunning her?
Dengue is not transmitted from person to person. So it's not, you know, that you can, for example, just give a very corny representation. You can't like cough on the other person and they, you know, they get dengue. The way in which it's transmitted, as I said, is via a mosquito. So in order for you to get dengue fever from your mother, the mosquito that would have bitten her would then have to bite you. So that's the primary way in which you can get dengue. There's some other ways as well, but it is not contagious in that type of way. The mosquito has to bite you in order for you to get dengue.
And you know, that may seem like a silly question, but in a day like today where we are surrounded by COVID, and as soon as you get a fever or a cough, everybody masks up, and even as they should, it's important to note the difference between conditions that are spread from person to person versus conditions that are vector-borne, because the precautions are going to be slightly different. Yeah? So that's one of the reasons why I brought that up. So what I wanted to touch on then would be these symptoms. We talked about the different types of dengue, the fact that you can go from asymptomatic all the way up to severe. We know that there's normal dengue and then there's severe dengue. Could you give us a picture of what the difference might look like? How might what we would call a patient present if they just have the normal run-of-the-mill dengue versus the severe dengue?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as I was saying, you might be asymptomatic. So you see no symptoms, nothing at all. So let's get out the way, you can have an asymptomatic dengue. The typical presentation that people will see would be fever. You generally get a very high fever, and I can almost recollect when I had dengue myself. You get a very, very high fever. You get headache. You can get muscle pain. So you can get muscle pain. You can get joint pain. You get the pain behind your eyes, what we call retroorbital pain. So when you move your eyes, it, you know, they kind of hurt. Sometimes you can get a rash over your body. You can get weakness sometimes. You might also not want to eat. You don't have the feeling to eat. Sometimes you might also get dizzy as well, kind of recollecting my symptoms. And so those can be some of the primary symptoms you see. So you get a fever, you get headache, you get eye pain, you get joint pain, you get muscle pain. You can get a rash, you can feel weak, you don't want to eat. Some persons might get a sore throat and so forth. But the primary thing is, you know, usually starts out with a very, very high fever. For when the fever usually abates for dengue after about day 4 or day 5. And, you know, with classic dengue, once the fever starts to disappear, then some of the symptoms also start to disappear as well. However, if you are going on to more severe dengue, then your fever might have, you know, it seems as though your fever would have gone between day 4 and day 5, but, you know, it can rebound. So you can get a fever again coming back, say, day 6, day 7. So you come back with a fever, but you don't only get a fever. You can also get bleeding. So persons can have presentations such as nausea and vomiting. They can have, as I said, the bleeding. So you can get a... So when you vomit... You can also, persons may also vomit blood. You can get bleeding from like the eyes, the mucous membranes. So you can get a GI bleed. So you might be stooling blood or have a passage with blood in it. You can your urine might also be tinged with blood as well. And then you can also present, as I said, with the very high fever, persons can start to get very weak. They might get more nausea and vomiting. Some persons might even have seizures and so forth. So that's the what I was describing would be your dengue hemorrhagic fever, because you have a presentation of blood. You can have blood coming from different orifices. So that's one category of severe dengue. And then you can go on to another. So some persons now, out of the ones with dengue hemorrhagic fever, can now go on to shock syndrome. And so this is where now you have signs of shock. Your organ systems might be starting to fail. You might get, your heart might be affected. You might get either rapid heart rate or so forth, rapid breathing. You might get a facial flush. Signs of shock will be what you'll be presented with at this particular point.
And that's where you don't want to get to, yeah?
No, that's not where you want to get to. So you have a low blood pressure, very low blood pressure, all of those. You can have a very low temperature. So then it's usually associated with a high fever, but you get what you will get. You might get a hypothermia, so you might get a low body temperature and so forth. So you might, you know, there are several things that can go on. That's definitely not where you want to go at, because with that, the mortality rate can be significantly increased.
Yes, the risk for death. And I want to come back and talk to you about when you see the signs of severe dengue, what you need to do. But we have a caller on the line, so we're going to welcome that caller. Good evening, caller. Welcome to Better Health.
Yes, merciful evening, Dr. Lewis. How are you?
I am well, thanks. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. Well, I want to thank you that all my blessings come from you. I bless you that I'm going to really need a touch from you, and we bless the man can curse. I love you for blessing me with your presence. Yes, I have a couple. Let me say good evening to the doctor as well, and thank Grayson for taking my call. I have a couple of questions based on this very great topic, because I myself had dengue 3 times, and, you know, I would want to know, starting, that I could have a vaccine for it. Is there a vaccine available? And if there is, how effective is it? If not, why isn't there a vaccine available for it as yet? My next question is, in terms of the genetics of the mosquito itself, this Aedes aegypti mosquito, we know that only the females actually bite or thing. So can you make it so that when they mate, you get more males, so that eventually the male gender gives a greater number, outnumbering the females, so that you would get less of the cases overall, because obviously the females are the ones that bite. The males really don't. And the other question is, based on climate change, Dr. Lewis, what would be the role of this great heat coming upon the world, that even the Europe, I'm not saying Antarctica, but Europe would be more susceptible to it because they're getting hotter themselves. And as the water heats up and so on, you know, you will be able to get the precipitation there, and there they may be able to proliferate. I'm not sure if the water, if the, in the stagnant water to which they proliferate in, would be hotter. And my next question deals with, the doctor would have mentioned tourism as well. I know, Dr. Marquita, that tourism is plays a great role in these diseases manifesting and presenting in terms of its import of symptoms and sometimes death. Now, I mentioned that I have I have had type 1, I've had type 2, and I've had type 3. The only one I've had is type 4. The only one I haven't had, is type 4. So I hope I don't get it. So I'm just hoping that with the tourism question, that you'll be able to answer it for me in terms of if I do go to a country even if I stay in Barbados, and I get like, for what I have to die, or would you be able to save me? I didn't want to say you brought it into my soul, and sure enough, there, girl. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, caller. Very, very interesting questions, actually. And I always have to take notes when you call, because the questions are intriguing. So the first question, Dr. Gittins, is about whether or not there's a vaccine.
Okay, so for a long time, there wasn't a vaccine. They've been, you know, trying to develop a vaccine. However, there currently is a vaccine available called DengiVax or DengaVax. It was only developed in 2015. The thing about this vaccine, though, is that it will be better. It has been developed for persons between the age of 9 to 16. Not that other persons can't take it, but that's what's been developed for. Because most persons who get dengue hemorrhagic fever are under 50 years of age. The thing about this vaccine, though, is that it is primarily used for persons who have had dengue from before. So like the caller, for example, he would benefit from such a vaccine. For persons who've never had the vaccine, who've never had dengue before, then it is the recommendation is that that person shouldn't take the vaccine because it predisposes them to developing more severe dengue. So I'm saying all that to say, yes, there is a vaccine available. Probably not on island. It's been rolled out very slowly. Only in 2019, the US has brought it on board. But as I said, it's used for in persons who've had dengue before and in places where persons are at risk for getting dengue. So someone who's not had dengue before, the vaccine is not recommended for those individuals, but there is a vaccine.
All right, that's a very comprehensive answer. And then the other one was whether we should be looking into genetic engineering, trying to get more males than females. I don't know if you would have an answer to that, but I'll throw it out anyway.
There is a bacteria called Wolbachia that what they find when mosquitoes have Wolbachia, particularly the females, is that it prevents the dengue virus from multiplying in the female, and it also causes the female to lay less eggs. So there have been places where this Wolbachia has been introduced into the mosquitoes, particularly the female mosquitoes. And they've seen a reduction in the number of mosquitoes being produced because of reduced the number of eggs that the mosquito is, then it's going to be overall abundance of mosquitoes. So it is one where it particularly causes reduce the
Yeah, Doc, I think your colleague is freezing a bit there. Seems to feed. Yeah.
Dr. Gittins, if you can hear me, maybe if you turn off your camera, because we're having some problems with the quality here. Dr. Gittins.
Yeah, I think she's completely frozen now.
She's frozen for a bit.
Yeah.
So we are hearing that there are some things that they're doing on the genetic side in terms of the dengue mosquito to help to reduce the population size. I don't know if that's something that's happening locally. It seems to be something that's happening overseas, but it's very interesting. When Dr. Gittins rejoins us, because we seem to have lost her, one of the things that I would be interested to touch on would be the role of climate change in dengue. Because in fact, we are seeing an increase in the cases of dengue. The incidence of dengue has increased 30-fold over the last 50 years, and that's pretty significant. And the question that I would pose to Dr. Gittins is whether or not the incidence has increased because of climate change. Is it that the incidence hasn't truly increased, but we're getting better at detection? But is there a role of climate change in the increase in dengue cases that we're seeing?
Okay, so in terms of climate change and the increase, one of the reasons why there have been an increase in recent years, like from 1990s onward, is because of, they've stopped some of the practices, for eradicating the mosquito. So they had used a lot of spraying before to actually eradicate the mosquitoes, but they've subsequently stopped that. So from the 70s onward, there've been an increase in dengue cases. With climate change, with the effects of, you know, El Nino and La Nina, where you might have increase in the rainfall and so forth, as well as flooding and increasing temperatures, surface waters, it makes the environment more likely or more sustainable for the mosquitoes to actually breed. So climate change can indeed play a role in the abundance of mosquitoes and hence the dissemination of the infection.
Okay. Yeah, that does make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last question, very, very important question he asked. He's basically saying he's had type 1, type 2, type 3. And one of the questions I had for you is whether or not you can get dengue more than once. But I think Corey dealt with that, and we know that you can get dengue more than once because they're different types. But his question was, if he were to get type 4, is it sure death for him? What would be your response?
No. Not sure. That's what you need to do is to, as soon as you recognize, if you know you've had dengue more than once, you're at risk for developing severe dengue. So dengue hemorrhagic fever, dengue shock syndrome. Once you know that you've had dengue from before and you start to see the symptoms of severe dengue, you know, your fever has gone beyond the 5 days and so forth, then it's best to present yourself to the emergency department.
Yeah.
So no delay, just go straight to emergency department because, you know.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into my next question, because I was going to ask, what should people do? Because like you said, if there's a prolonged fever or if the fever stops and then rebounds, that's a telltale sign. You talked about the bleeding, severe abdominal pain, those kind of things. You don't want to delay, but you want to present yourself as soon as possible. For emergency care. So once you get there, can you share with the public, how do we typically diagnose that it's dengue? Is it just a matter of saying this sounds like dengue and putting a diagnosis on you, or is there a more sure way that we can diagnose dengue?
Okay, so we wish that there was a way of looking at it and saying, yes, you had dengue. But no, that's not the way. You have to get a blood test drawn, and there are several ways or several tests that can be performed. And it depends on when you come into the infection. So early in the course of the infection, so say you started to get your symptoms early on, so up to day 4 or so, you can come to the doctor and you can still be diagnosed with dengue. So you can do PCR, and I'm sure you've heard that term before when we were talking about COVID. You can get your blood drawn, and a PCR test can be performed that will definitively say, yes, this person has dengue, and it can also tell you the type of dengue the person has. There's also another type of test, which looks at a specific antigen, an NS1 ELISA test, that can also be done very early in the course of infection, and that also can say, you know, if the person has dengue or not. If you come later on, so 5 days and beyond, there's another test that you can do, which can also detect dengue as well. But this is where you're looking particularly for antibodies. So if you, the primary thing is, if you know that you have, or you're presenting with signs of dengue, or you think that you have dengue, you come early and you can get your blood drawn, and then the test can be performed. So you'll be able, as I said, you can do a PCR test or an S1 test that can tell you if you have dengue. If you come a little bit later, then you can also diagnose it by other tests as well. But a blood test is the primary. A blood sample has to be drawn, which will then be used in these tests.
Okay, excellent. And with that, we have our second caller for the evening. Good evening, caller, and welcome to Better Health.
Good evening, and thanks for having me on. My question is, let me just make the statement. I have been hearing that sometimes patients are being misdiagnosed. with leptospirosis. Are you all familiar with that? That sometimes people are mistakenly diagnosed with dengue when it actually is leptospirosis. Is that something common?
Right, so I'm going to post that question. You're asking the perfect person, caller. I don't know if you heard the introduction in terms of profile, but very experienced in terms of leptospirosis. And so, yes, Dr. Gittins, I want you to answer the caller's question, but also, you know, in terms of the clinical differences between dengue and leptospirosis, are there any that we might want to think of, consider? So how easy is it to mix up the two?
Okay. So... okay. You can, because he said, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please. You're breaking up a bit, but go ahead.
Hello. So, leptospirosis, it presents. Condition of leptospirosis and dengue can be very similar because you can have a fever for both of them, but then it starts to, you know, look a little different. So for leptospirosis, you can have jaundice, so your eyes might become yellow, your stools might become pale, your body might become yellow, your urine might become darker because your liver might be affected. You can also have the same joint pain, muscle pain, and so forth, but you don't have normally the retroorbital pain. So that pain on moving your eyes or behind your eyes, you generally don't have that. And so those are some of the primary things you will see for leptospirosis. So persons might think that it is, you know, that there is it's a similarity between, or there's some sort of overlapping symptoms between dengue fever and leptospirosis, because they all start as a fibrosis, more so when you start jaundice, which is not a particular indication or a presentation with dengue fever. So that's why you might see some similarities in that way. Now, what also happens is because of the similarity between dengue in terms of initial presentation, is that the lab can also do a leptospirosis test as well. So it might, and then that might be positive as opposed to the dengue test. So the physician might recognize, you know, it's very hard to distinguish at this point in time the two. So they would request that both tests be done, and then the leptospirosis test might become positive, even though you might have thought that you had dengue.
Yep, I think that's a pretty thorough answer to that question. There are key differences, even though there is the risk of misdiagnosis. In terms of how often it happens, we would not be able to say because we would need data to say how often that happens. But I can see how it could occur. And that's why testing is very important. It might be more expensive. It's going to add on to the doctor's visit because you have to pay the lab fees and so forth. But it is critically important that you know what you're dealing with. So thank you so much for that question, caller. So one of the things that I want to know then, you have these symptoms, you're concerned, and you present to your doctor, what kind of treatment is available for persons who have dengue? Does the treatment, for example, differ based on if you have dengue type 1 versus dengue type 4? I would imagine it may be different if you have, you know, a milder form versus a more severe form, but all in all, what does that look like?
Okay, so there is no drug that will cover dengue fever. So there's no particular antiviral agent out there that covers dengue. It's primarily symptomatic treatment. So you will treat for the fever, you will treat for if the person has any pain and so forth. And that's for your typical dengue signs. So that's the doctor's going to tell you, well, go and take some Panadol, some acetaminophen, but certainly you shouldn't take anything like aspirin or anything or corticosteroids. Those are things you should not take at all. But there's no drug. Once you go on to develop more severe.
Before you go on, we do have a caller. There's a question I wanted to ask you, but I'll ask you after the caller. Good evening, caller. Welcome to Mental Health.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for having this program this evening, especially now with the rainy season and heat and rain. I do agree with what the prior caller spoke about with the mix-up between dengue and leptospirosis, because I had an acute form of dengue hemorrhagic, and initially I was told that I potentially had leptospirosis because I was presenting those symptoms, and it took over 2 weeks to confirm that I did have an acute form of dengue. So I really appreciate you sharing this information this evening.
Oh, well, we are very glad that you're still here with us to share your experience. You know, even though we don't like to go through those experiences, we're glad that you made it out on the other side. So thank you so much sharing that with us this evening. And I think I'm going to go back to what I was asking Dr. Gittins, but I just want to stick a pin there. How long does it typically take to get back results? I think that's a really good question that the public may want to know. If you're sending in for dengue titers or any of the other tests, how long should it take before you get back those results?
Okay, so typically you should get results back in 1 to 2 weeks. And that's because with the type of tests that is being done, particularly if you're doing serological tests, they're usually done in batches. So you generally accumulate a certain number, and then you will perform those tests. So it usually takes between 1 to 2 weeks.
So then what can the person do in the meantime, or the clinician do in the meantime as they're awaiting these results? There's something that you mentioned that I wanted to really speak to. You talked about not using aspirin or corticosteroids. I wanted to know if there are any other drugs you shouldn't use, but really I wanted to know why shouldn't people use these drugs even as they await their results?
So with the aspirin and those corticosteroids and so forth, they actually result in more like intensification of the symptoms, and they also would result in more just intensification of the symptoms and so forth. And because of the way they work, it is best not to take them because they can also affect the heart, clotting and so forth, and therefore you don't really want to take any of those. The paracetamol and acetaminophen wouldn't have those types of adverse effects, and so it's fine to use those just to treat your pain and so forth, but certainly not the aspirin or the other drugs.
Yeah, I think that's really important for people to recognize. If you have a febrile illness, so you spike a fever, the first thing you grab should not be aspirin, but really you should be looking to use something like Panadol, paracetamol in the interim until you can get to your doctor. So I just wanted that message to really go out there in a strong way. And then based on what the last caller has said about the mix-up and not being sure and all of that, like we said before, it's really important to get tested. So even though, I know I said this already, even though it might cost a bit, even if your doctor doesn't bring it up, because your doctor might say, it sounds like dengue, you know. But if your doctor does not bring it up, feel free to ask a question about, you know, can I have the test done and what would be the cost and that kind of thing, that you can make an informed decision so that you know what you're dealing with. So So Dr. Gittins, we were talking about treatment. So we had gotten to the part about medication and so forth, and we were talking about treating the symptoms in case of mild dengue. So I'm going to let you continue along that vein, what the treatment might look like.
Okay, so in terms of treatment of, as I said, in terms of mild dengue and so forth, it would generally be symptomatic treatment. So you're only treating your symptoms, any pain, and you want to make sure the person has adequate hydration. So you make sure they have a good fluids and they have adequate bed rest, because I can tell you that after dengue, you feel as though you've been through the ringer for the next 2 weeks because you're extremely fatigued and everything makes you tired. So adequate bed rest and adequate hydration. And as I said, making sure you take the drugs to treat your fever and pain and so forth, those are what will be used. In terms of more severe dengue, where you have dengue, hemorrhagic fever, or dengue shock syndrome, then as I said, those persons should go to the hospital, and they will be hospitalized and managed according to hospital treatment. So then they would have to undergo, particularly if they have low blood pressure or so forth, they have to be given a lot of fluid replacements or volume replacement. They have to undergo a whole different, a whole range or a whole battery of tests. They have to check for all the different types of enzymes, the function of the liver, the heart, and so forth. So they have to go through all of those. But in particular, you want to make sure that you have, in the hospital, you are treated also appropriately for your symptoms, but you're obviously given fluid replacements and so forth to make sure that your blood does not undergo further coagulation, that you don't get further clots or whatever developing, because then that can lead to your demise.
Right.
Don't want to go into too technical, because then make sure that they will still give you your treatment for fever. Make sure you don't have any respiratory distress, those types of things. Make sure your platelet levels are at an adequate level, because with dengue hemorrhagic fever, your platelet count can decrease. So you have to bring those up and stuff like that. So that's quite important in terms of treatment. Once the person has hemorrhagic fever, you always want to treat them as soon as possible.
Excellent. So we have another caller on the line. Caller, good evening. Welcome to Better Health.
Yes, great evening, Dr. Lewis. I just wanted to call to thank you and congratulate you on your newest achievement. I hope you get the success, and not just the attempt, but the success at your endeavor at this time. So I want to congratulate you for that. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Praise God. Love and Christ. Yeah, I have a quick question here on the solution in terms of the barrier to mosquitoes. In terms of the presentation of the four types, would things like fogging, citronella, vitamin B1, thiamine, or any of the others, would that be a particularly effective barrier so you don't get it in the first place? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Gittins?
Okay, so the most effective things, one of the primary things that they use in terms of prevention is fogging, who covers the adult mosquitoes. But one of the other things, you can also cover the larvae as well. In terms of using vitamins and so forth to prevent dengue, that I'm not fully aware of how those would be useful, but certainly in terms of making sure your surroundings are clean, that you wear repellent, that you wear protective clothing, your long sleeves, your long pants and so forth, that you have well screened areas, that you get rid of all water containing vessels around the house, check your gutters, all those types of things. Use mosquito bed nets, impregnated insecticide impregnated mosquito bed nets. And so forth. Those will be more important in terms of, you know, making sure you're not getting bitten, as opposed to, you know, using various vitamins and so forth that might not necessarily prevent or counteract dengue infection.
And speaking of getting bitten, what are the times of day that you're more likely to be bitten by an Aedes aegypti mosquito?
So the female mosquito usually bites during the day. So it's more of a day biting mosquito. So sometimes they at one point it was, you know, it would say, well, they will bite early morning or the evening or so forth. But, you know, they've kind of like where we live, they've been more urbanized and they bite during the day. So they're biting mosquitoes. And, you know, if you have flesh available at any point in time, they will bite you.
And that's why it is so important to keep around you as clean as possible, free of water as possible. Because the mosquitoes are evolving, like you said, they live where we live, and they say, hey, we ain't only doing the nighttime, they be coming up during the day. We jam in during the day as well.
Yeah. Right?
So, that's very interesting. So the other question then, we talked a lot about prevention, and I love how our callers are able to just fill in those gaps. That's actually the next thing that I was going to talk about, in terms of, you know, how persons can prevent getting dengue. Is there anything, talk about the environment, but in terms of these things that you rub on your skin and all that kind of thing, how effective is that? Is that something that you would recommend? Mosquito repellents, etc.
Yes, using those repellents can work, particularly the DEET containing mosquito repellents. Those generally work very well in making sure that, or preventing mosquito from biting. Of course, you need to reapply them. We need to reapply them several times, particularly if you're consistently outdoors. But those actually do work well. I would have mentioned the clothing and so forth, making sure you have the areas, you know, your windows are and so forth are screened in and are air conditioned. And in terms of the environment, the external environment, making sure the areas outside are clean. So making sure you don't have any tires or any buckets of standing water, or any vessels containing standing water, because it doesn't take much for a mosquito to grow. They can grow in, they can, you know, lay their eggs in a cap, a bottle cap. That's enough for them to grow. They can grow in, you know, the your vases, where you might keep your plants or flowers or so forth, even in your dish racks, where the water settles there, they can lay their eggs there. So it's just important to make sure you eliminate all sources. Also things like poor sanitation and poor refuge also provides an excellent environment for mosquito larvae to grow. And so therefore it's good to make sure or you don't have any of those things accumulating or around you. You want to make sure that your surroundings are very much pristine. So make sure that if you have ponds or, you know, pools that you can put your, or even standing bodies of water, you can put your dumps and so forth, your mosquito dumps in it to keep the water buoyant so that the mosquito doesn't lay eggs in the water. You can also cover the water with a film of oil so as to prevent them from also laying their eggs in the water. But it's making sure primarily to get rid of the water.
You mentioned your mosquito, there's something, mosquito dumps, you said?
Yeah, so they're dumps that you can actually put in the water. If you have like standing pools of water, and this will kind of keep the water kind of moving so that it the mosquitoes are unable to later eggs.
Okay, I honestly can't say that I knew about that, but yeah, that's very useful information for sure. So talked about prevention. If you do get dengue, we talked about treatment. Are there any long-term effects? Should I be concerned? Just say, oh, you have long COVID, or, you know, other conditions that can lead to sequelae of issues. Are there any long-term effects of dengue?
No, there are no long-term effects unless you get like a real severe dengue, maybe shock or something, and you have some after effect from that. But normally there are no severe effects. You might get tired. So, you know, you might, dengue generally lasts for about a week or so. Classical dengue, that is. But then you can feel lethargic and fatigue for about 2 to 3 weeks afterwards. Mm-hmm. But then after that, you are normal. You will go back to your regular state of health. There's no long dengue, or like how they had chikungunya, you can get your joint pains years afterwards. No.
And should persons who are pregnant then be worried about dengue affecting the fetus or the unborn child?
With pregnant persons, there is the possibility of transmitting dengue from mother to child. So it's not a commonality, it's not very common, but there's the possibility, and there have been instances where it can happen. Same way that it can be transmitted sexually as well. So it is important for pregnant women to, it's more important for pregnant women to be mindful of this as well, because, you know, it can actually affect, as I said, it can affect the newborn, and you don't want anything like that to happen. And sometimes it can look like other manifestations as well. So it's really important for pregnant women to be mindful of dengue, and making sure too that their surroundings are clean, because they don't want to transmit it to their neonate at all. They have been deaths associated with persons who've had dengue, pregnant women with dengue. And so, you know, as I said, particularly in the third trimester, but you don't, you know, as I said, with everybody else, you don't, as being pregnant, you don't, absolutely don't want to get dengue.
This is dengue. When you say death, this is death of the fetus in the third trimester, or death of the mother and fetus?
Death of the mother.
Okay. Well, yeah, so you're not scaring pregnant people. But suffice to say, you know, that extra layer of protection is extremely important. We know that mummies like to do everything that they can to keep that pregnancy safe, to keep that baby safe. So it's good that we have that information out there. And I know that you mentioned that dengue can be sexually transmitted, which might have sent off some red flags for our listeners, so that we don't have a bunch of angry husbands calling in to the station. Hey, please let us know. How common is that? Is that something that's common, or is it rare?
It is very rare. It's not very common at all. It's like the same vertical transmission from mother to child. It's not very common, but it's a possibility. The possibility is not very high, but there's a possibility. It's actually been a few cases, but it's not very common at all.
All right. We don't want to cut out any action for people, yeah? So, not common. Yes, just one of those things that we know happens, right? So ladies, you're not using that as an excuse. Gentlemen, you're not using it either, right? All right. So Dr. Gittins, time is fast approaching. I just wanted to know, are there any closing comments that you wanted to give, any encouragement for the public related to dengue, anything that you wanted to share?
I say that dengue is, we think, you know, because sometimes we get in a comfort zone and we think that we may not be affected by dengue, or we hear it so commonly that it's just like, oh, this is dengue. But we need to recognize that is an infection that can result in death. And so we need to pay very special attention to it, particularly if you've had dengue before. Because if you've had dengue once and you get dengue again, it increases your risk of more severe dengue. So once you've recognized or know that you've bitten and you're starting to experience symptoms, please go to your healthcare provider, get the test done so that we can say for sure that you've had that you have dengue. Even though it may cost a bit more for your visit, it is important, because you know, with the test, we can also determine if you've had dengue before. It can put you on your guard to say, look, you need to watch out for this. You need to watch out for X, Y, and Z. You need to watch out for bleeding and so forth. If you see this happening, come in, because we know that you've had dengue before. So it is absolutely important to get tested. It's absolutely important to be mindful of your symptoms. It's absolutely important. If you know that you have dengue or you've been bitten, you start experiencing symptoms, come in early, as early as possible, because the test, the earlier test, can specifically help you to help to identify that is dengue, and can also type the dengue as well.
Excellent, excellent advice. Probably I want to thank you so much, Dr. Gittins, for being with us this evening. Let me say a special thank you to all of our listeners, those who would have called in and engaged with us. We are very grateful. We always are for you. And we've had a very good session this evening on dengue. I just want to make a very quick announcement. This is going to likely be my last, one of my last, if not my last show with you for a long time. I will be traveling to the UK to further my studies for a year. And so I just want to take the opportunity to thank the station for having me. I want to take the opportunity to thank all of you listeners. I've had a really, really good time with BetterHelp. It's something that I enjoy. And I am hopeful that in some capacity I can be with you. Just to say thank you so much. I'm wishing you all the best. Continue to take good care of yourself. The show will continue, so to continue to tune in to our show at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening, 6:30 when there's cricket. And we look forward to continuing to educate and engage you. I said continue a few too many times. But yes, this is just to say my goodbyes to you in case I am not here with you again.
Okay, Dr. Lewis, thank you so kindly, and let me just wish you the best as well. Your one of your callers extended that greeting and wished to you as well. So on behalf of all the listening public, let me say to you, best of luck to you in your future endeavors. It was a pleasure having you here, and of course, you know you're welcome back any time. So thank you kindly.
Thank you.
And you take care of yourself as well. And also to your guest this evening, Dr. Marquita Gittins-Hilaire, thank you for your presence here this evening. And of course, I'm quite sure you'll be back in some other capacity as well, Dr. Gittins, as I said earlier. So thank you all kindly. Have yourselves a wonderful evening and take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. There you go. The good doctor is there for you on the Better Health Radio Show.